all. We are up here for...
So let's join together in prayer. Gracious and loving God, may the meditations of our hearts and the words of my lips, if they be your words, be worthy and acceptable unto you. And may your word come to your people now, either through me or despite me. Amen. So thanks for the invitation to be here. I don't call myself retired or semi-retired anymore. I use the term, I'm a fourth quarter human being. So I'm in the last 25 years of life. And I do a bunch of things. And alongside of being an ordained United Church minister, I was 26 years in the Canadian Army Reserve. And it'll become clear as we talk a little bit about sort of what that was about. So when I thought about today, I thought, well, you know, I could probably preach a pretty crackerjack sermon on Micah 4, or I could regale you with tales of deployment in Afghanistan, but it just didn't seem the right thing to do. So I decided I would lift up two themes. So one is remembrance, and the other is the cost of war. The cost of war, both of which are important for people who follow Jesus, because Micah talks about the peaceable kingdom, that God, even though it doesn't feel like it at times, that it is God's intention to bring that peaceable kingdom to fruition in our world. And so as Christians, we don't just trust our intuition or hope for a better outcome. We trust that in the midst of this mess we live in, that God is bringing about the peaceable kingdom. Now, over the years, November 11th has morphed into many things. The original Remembrance Day on November 11th was actually a huge pool of grief and loss right after the First World War, where across Canada, 66,000 Canadian servicemen and women did not come back to this country. They were buried where they fell. Their families had no place to remember them, and so in a flurry of cenotaph building all across Canada, which included putting up those names, people gathered together right after the First World War to grieve and to remember sacrifice. Now, Remembrance Day has kind of evolved. It's a bit of a community parade. It's become a Thank All Veterans Day. Unfortunately, I think it's tinged with a little bit of nationalism and a little bit of Christian nationalism. And if you're laying a wreath, woe betide to the politician that doesn't show up to lay a wreath on Remembrance Day. They will be flooded the next week by hateful emails from their insulted constituents. But it has really only one purpose: to remember the Canadians who've died. And since the Books of Remembrance were put into the Peace Tower, there's been over 120,000 Canadian military personnel who've died, whose names are recorded, that we know about. So if you came in here, I hope you were a little disconcerted when you tried to figure out whether your seat had been taken up by a piece of ordnance. And it was interesting to watch all of you. It is somewhat unsettling to come into a place of peace and to find the detritus of war. And I watched some of you try to figure out whether you were going to move it, whether you were going to touch it. So, the cost of war. Well, everything you see there is meant to be shot at another human being and blow up into small pieces and kill them, as are these shells here, all of which are deactivated, by the way. So imagine during the First World War, And since the First World War, literally billions of these things have been shot at human beings by other human beings. And if you watch war movies, you will never see the effect of shrapnel on the human body. If you watch people getting shot on TV, if you play video games, you get shot, there's this little hole here. Probably the closest you'll ever see on public television or in the movies is if you saw the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan, or if you've watched Netflix's All Quiet on the Western Front, you'll get a little sense of what war in all its many things are like. So let's just reflect a little bit on how much war costs. Let's talk about the environment. We're all in the midst, as we know, of a climate crisis. The world's militaries account for 6% yearly of all carbon emissions into our atmosphere. If the United States military was a country, it would rank number 47 in the emitter of greenhouse gases. Since the supposed war on terror that we all know about, 12 billion metric tons of harmful emissions have been put into our atmosphere, which is the equivalent of 267 million cars. And it's not just the air. There is no such thing as waste management and recycling in war. When wars are fought, stuff is left where it is. Stuff is buried. Stuff is put into the sea without any regard for the toxicity of all of that material. When I was in Kandahar, at that point, there were 20,000 military personnel on the base. Kandahar was a NATO base for a number of years. At one end of it, we had this huge burn pit, and everything went into that burn pit. There are cases now emerging in the United States of American military personnel who have lung cancer, because they breathed what went into the air. At the other end of CAF, there was this man-made lake, and every ounce of human waste went untreated into that lake. We referred to it as the SHIT pond, and depending on how the wind was blowing, it was a pretty rank smell. But just imagine that's all in the earth. And countries like the Balkans, Afghanistan, all the countries around Vietnam, even large sections of France and Belgium are littered with the unexploded ordnance and mines. And so you had a little sense of what people all around the world experience when they have to come even into a church or go to school and kind of keep an eye out and go, oh, there's a bomb. Is it still alive? And not only is it unexploded ordnance, but it is mines. And mines are actually designed by all countries not to kill you. They're designed to maim you. Some of them are designed to look like children's toys so that young children will pick them up, thinking that they're attracted to the colors. And the reason being, destroys your enemy's morale if they see people walking around without arms and legs. And it takes incredible resources to take a wounded soldier off the battlefield, which distracts the military from the people that it's fighting. So it's an insidious, insidious thing. In war zones, 90% of the wildlife is usually exterminated. Afghanistan has 5% left of its forest cover. And this does not include the destruction of heritage sites, infrastructure, hospitals, schools, government services. All of these things just get obliterated in war. And then the second cost of war is money. It's no big secret why the Great Depression ended at the beginning of the Second World War, because there is money to be made in war. Let's use the Ukraine as a quick example. You know, all those billions upon billions of dollars of munitions and war supplies that are being expended in the Ukraine, many which have come from Canada and other NATO countries, that all has to be replaced. And what that means is that those things are needed now, so procurement processes become sloppy and they become open to overpricing and corruption. So Canada, we're a minor player in the Ukraine. You'll read, well, we sent 4 artillery pieces and 1,000 shells to help the Ukraine army. Well, each of those shells costs $100,000. It's the capitalist dream. When demand is high and supply is low, the economy prospers. And so defense spending all around the world is close to $1 trillion a year. And in our little wee country of Canada, we have a defense budget of $21 billion. There are 900 companies, 14,000 people producing war supplies that are worth $2.2 billion a year. And we are a really, really small military. Well, let's talk about people. There's no doubt that the first casualty of war after truth, maybe it's the second casualty of war, is people. So I'm going to distribute some things to you to help you get a sense of what military loss is like. I'm going to ask Bruce to come along and give me a hand. So if you're an American, when you die, your family gets a Purple Heart. If you're a Canadian, they get a Memorial Cross. Here, Bruce, I'll get you to take that one too. And I debated a little bit about this one because it has a swastika on it. And I'm not a German Nazi fan or collector, but it's a German Mother's Cross. So it reminds us that even the enemy has mums. And when I was in Afghanistan, of course, it was a pretty bitter war. And I would go out with our Canadian soldiers. We would go out with the Afghan National Army. We'd kill a bunch of Taliban, right? Not people, insurgents. I'll just pass this one around. And they'd all cheer. And sometimes our folks would cheer, right? Because you're caught up in the adrenaline of war. And I would always quietly say, the people we just killed had mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters. And if you go down below the level of politics, they are grieving just as we would grieve. And so there's a couple of other things I'll pass around too, just to kind of sort of make this point. Some of it are things that are given to people in war. Some of them are memorials that people have created. I just take the bottom one there. I'll get Bruce to pass that around. If you died in the First World War, alongside of the Memorial Cross, you got this plaque with your loved one's name on it. It's referred to in slang terms as a death penny. I'll pass that one around. It's a postcard of a German soldier mourning the death of a friend. It just kind of reminds us that all human beings mourn. Because a lot of effort in wartime is put into what we call propaganda. If you were alive during the Second World War, or you remember any of that, you will remember propaganda. And the whole purpose of propaganda is to convince those of us fighting on one side that we're right and that we have God on our side, and the other person is wrong, they don't have God on their side, and then we give them names like the Hun, Jerry. In Afghanistan, the Taliban were referred to as ragheads or as Hajis. And what that does is depersonalize your enemy, because we're not wired to kill other human beings. Like, that's not God's intention. So I'll pass these. These are actually some propaganda postcards from the First World War. Anybody know or remember the story of when Edith Cavell was shot by the Germans as a British spy in the First World War. Well, anyway, it was she was a nurse. It's questionable whether she was actually guilty, but these are, Bruce, I'll get you to pass this one around. These are postcards produced by the Allies to demonize the Germans for the act of shooting Edith Cavell. Okay, so we talked about people. Well, civilians. You know, there's a tremendous loss of civilians in war. It's not new. It goes all the way back to the beginning of time. Ethnic cleansing, rape, plunder, destruction, and its sole purpose, apart from soldiers getting out their rage, is basically to make the soldiers at the front worry about their families back at home, and that way they won't be so effective. And so, you know, millions upon millions of civilians have been killed over the course of the war. And then, of course, physically injured soldiers. So you've all seen the pictures. But I will tell you that all governments intentionally keep from us the real pictures of what war wounds look like. Because if you saw them, you would experience trauma. So you'll occasionally see an amputee, and you'll usually hear a story about how heroic they are because they've overcome their amputation. But all through the 20th century, there have been literally thousands of soldiers horribly maimed by the excess of war, and we've all benefited from it because that's how plastic surgery got developed. That's how all the marvelous surgical techniques that we enjoy in our world now, they all came from treating soldiers on the battlefield with their horrendous wounds. So physically injured soldiers. And then there are the families of people who serve in the military. Think about their trauma and their anxiety. So it gets a bit personal for me because my wife Kathy is over there. And our daughter went to Afghanistan for about 10 months to work as a civilian employee of the military, supporting soldiers. She came back in July of 2007. I left in August of 2007 for 16 months of training and deployment. So Kathy would be the one that can tell you what it's like to live every day, every moment of the day, wondering where your loved one is, what's happening to them, are they safe, and dreading the knock on your door of someone like me and a senior officer who's going to tell you that your loved one has been killed in war. And I've done that more times than I care to remember. Now, the last thing, the unseen wounds of war on veterans. My phrase is that every veteran is a wounded veteran, whether you can see the wound or not. So I've got a 6-minute video here that I'm going to show you. It was a video that was made up along with a group of military veterans. We're going to get that queued up in just a minute. No, he's got it. I came prepared. Time spent in reconnaissance is seldom wasted. So this group of people got together. They made these 6-minute audio stories. They chose the pictures. They wrote their story. It was how they'd been affected mentally by their time in service. They were shown to some of their friends, and when those people got together, unless their friends knew or family knew exactly what had happened to them, most of them were surprised. They said, well, we kind of knew that you'd had a tough time at war, but we didn't really think it was anything like this. And then, of course, a number of people said, well, we knew that it hadn't been a pleasant experience, but we'd been afraid to ask you. So this is one of those stories.
I would describe myself as a lonely child of the 60s. Dominated by anxiety and its cousin depression, I had no words to describe what I felt. Mental illness was shrouded in silence and shame. Finding words for my angst has been as hard as feeling it. I have survived a close brush with suicide. I am a United Church minister. I'm a parent and a grandparent, and served 26 years as a chaplain in the Army. Brush with suicide. I would describe myself as a lonely child of the 60s. Dominated by anxiety and its cousin depression, I had no words to describe what I felt. Mental illness was shrouded in silence and shame. Finding words for my angst has been as hard as feeling it. I have survived a close brush with suicide. I am a United Church minister. I'm a parent and a grandparent, and served 26 years as a chaplain in the Army Reserve. My life partner, Kathy, was the first person I dared to describe my constant torment to. Preparing to deploy to Afghanistan, I was not fully aware that my inner landscape was fertile for a moral injury. As senior chaplain from the reserves, I assured my team of regular force chaplains that we would get all the support we needed. They laughed. Being more seasoned than me, they said, "Jim, you've drunk the Kool-Aid. When deployed, we will only have each other." They were right. The challenges of deployment to a war zone were amplified by broken promises of support from the chaplain home front, which were distracting, confusing, demanding, and stress-inducing. In the combat zone, my team and I knew no one had our back. We felt alone and abandoned by our own. One night, having escorted the remains of three Canadian soldiers to the morgue, sitting in a lonely office, the air smelling of diesel, dust, and an aura of death hanging over me, I received an email which challenged my actions in this war-torn hell. The words of which drove an axe into my heart. Stunned, I said to myself, "I'm done." Returning to Canada at tour's end, I was angry, flushed with shame, and deeply wounded by what I came to recognize as a moral injury, or a soul wound brought on by the double betrayal of promised support not received from military leaders who were also from my family of faith. I have survived by the grace of God and the mercy of other people. The acceptance and affection particular people gave me saved my life. Despite counseling, medication, and my own efforts, I could not lift from my chest the heavy stone of shame I carried. Years later, I found myself in a church service with the person whose condemnation from years ago had so impacted the trajectory of my experience. Anxiety flooded my chest. My first thought was to bolt out the door. My back dripped with cold, clammy sweat. I was frozen in position. At the service end, I had 15 minutes before my ride to the airport. What to do, what to say. Somehow, I found myself standing in front of this man, and I blurted out, "I have been angry at you for years, and I cannot carry that anger any longer." He looked me in the eyes and said, "I am sorry for what I did to you, Jim." With those words, the stone of shame I had carried all those years lifted off my chest. Light flooded into my chest cavity. If, as you listen to my words, you are suffering alone in silence, I implore you to find someone who is worthy to hear and hold your story. And say to them, "I have been having a tough time, and I need to talk. I cannot promise you that it will be easy, but I can say it will be worth it in the long run."
So that's the reality of unseen wounds in war. I showed this video to some people who don't know me well, or who I have never talked to, and they were totally surprised. They said, "But you look so well, Jim. Like, you came home and you talked and you went back to work." And I go, "Right. The unseen wounds of war." Anybody want to guess how many veterans there are in Canada today? I'll give you a little clue. There's 20,000 World War II veterans left. There's 5,000 Korean War veterans left. So anybody who's a veteran, basically you served in the Army, Air Force, and Navy, primary reserve or regular force for a year and got an honorable discharge. How many veterans in our country? Just guess. How many? 100,000, okay. Anybody else want to guess? We're a small country. 431,000 veterans identified on the 2021 census. Veterans Affairs has a budget of $6.28 billion. They spend 90% of it on veteran care. That's just for 1 year, and it will increase as the years go by, as many of our younger veterans age. So that's the cost of war. I receive support from Veterans Affairs. I have a number of physical ailments, and of course, as you saw there, I have a moral injury. I figure by the time I die, hopefully I'll live long enough to enjoy life. My case alone probably will cost our country $500,000. So that lets us end then, because I've gone on a bit longer than I should have. But people, there's some people here from Ladner, and they know I'm a long preacher. They were probably surprised to see me put my watch here. But I'm just going to end by saying that's why those words from Micah are so important. So just imagine what all that money that I've talked about could do, you know, if spears were plowshares and pruning hooks and we grew food and we built hospitals and we solved homelessness and we seriously worked on climate change. Imagine what it would be like if we didn't dedicate so much of our knowledge to the incredible science of killing one another. Imagine what it would be like to live in the peaceable kingdom. Imagine what it would be like if we sat around a banquet table with our enemies instead of digging trenches to kill one another. Imagine what it would be like if all those resources were redistributed around the world, irregardless of religion, and all world religions are horrible inflamers of conflict and violence. We're seeing that in the States nowadays. So I'll just show you my symbol of swords into plowshares. Anybody know what we have here? Two propellers. They're worth $2,600 each. They're usually used once because when the vehicle that had these propellers in Afghanistan landed, they usually chipped. So I asked the guys that I work with to make me a cross. So I jokingly say, this is my $5,200 cross provided by the Canadian government, and it's a sword turned into a plowshare. And that's what, apart from remembrance, for Christians, that's what Friday is about. Not only do we remember sacrifice, but we commit ourselves to pray and work for peace. Amen.